Okay. You were telling us on the other side about working at the beginning of with Jack Warden. What was the name of that company?
Carnes and Mitchell. C-A-R-N-E-S and Mitchell, M-I-T-C-H-E-R.
Can we go back a little bit?
Sure.
While we have this break? What was the date of your wedding? Or the year, anyhow?
The date was August 27th, 1950.
Okay. August
27th? 1950.
Okay. Now, let's go back once more to Duke. What you mentioned that you registered voters, black and white?
Black and white, yes.
Were there any restrictions on the blacks for voting, for registering?
There were lots of counties in North Carolina and certainly in other states where blacks were discouraged from voting. It was legal for them to vote, but there were lots of ways in which they were discouraged from voting. But in the major counties, for example, Durham County, Chapel Hill, which is where the University of North Carolina was a very liberal county. The western end of the state, there were was very liberal. I mean, they had been Lincoln Republicans, so there was no problem in that part of the state. If you got into the peanut areas of Rocky Mount and east, there were lots of problems with getting blacks to, or allowing blacks to vote. But some were voters. I mean, some were businessmen. For example, when we were traveling around, we would often stay. We didn't have any money for doing this, so we would often stay with some black businessman in his house, which was a bit risky for him to do because we weren't exactly welcomed by the people in the political establishment in North Carolina. Usually it would be someone like the Undertaker, who would be prominent in the black community. Since white undertakers didn't bury blacks, that was an opportunity for blacks to be in business. And so there was also in North Carolina at that time a very large and very wealthy black family that owned a black insurance company.
Do you remember the name of it?
No, I don't remember the name. North Carolina Life or something like that, but I wouldn't be certain.
Mm-hmm. Now, could you explain what some of the restrictions were on blacks in those lesser counties?
They were more intimidation than, they were intimidation. That is, it was not considered a good thing to do. And of course, in those at that time, I mean, you knew, you didn't have to have a road map to know when you're in the black area. As soon as you got into the black areas of the town, the streets were unpaved. I mean, there were no sidewalks. I mean, it was quite, the discrimination took other forms than just personal. I mean, property lines were not, that is, they just didn't provide many city services in those areas.
Right. Were there literacy tests or poll tax?
I don't remember whether they had literacy, I just don't remember whether they had literacy tests in
poll tax, do you know?
Well, North Carolina was a relatively liberal southern state, even though what I'm describing doesn't sound very liberal. But, I mean, when we compared ourselves to Mississippi or South Carolina, it was somewhat better in North Carolina. So I don't remember whether we had a poll tax. I don't believe they had a poll tax at that time as a reason for voting. They may have had a poll tax, but I don't think it was a cause of voting. It was mostly literacy, and just in the southern areas, it was just something that you didn't want to do.
Have you any idea how many voters you yourself registered?
No, I don't remember that.
How about your team?
We went through with these petitions, collecting names and in groups of four or five, but I don't remember how many actual signatures I got.
Okay.
I remember plodding around doing that. That's something you don't forget.
How'd your family feel about what you were doing?
Well, my father didn't care for this at all. I mean, he thought he was certainly not sympathetic to it at all. But remember, he was in California and I was in North Carolina, so I just didn't write about that sort of thing. I mean, we corresponded regularly, and he sent me money and supported me while I was there. But I just didn't write or talk about it a lot.
Okay. Now let's get back to your early married life. You're working still in California.
Yes.
Okay. Do you want to go on from there?
Sure.
What happened next? This is the Korean War.
Korean War, right. And I was working, and I think we went through the part that we sold the business in 1951, and I went to work at Carnes and Mitchell, doing their office work and being responsible for that. And I was describing about Jack Gordon and how he would come in late in the day. Well, one day he came in, and he loved to read the want ads, and he would find all sorts of things in the want ad. So he had buses that he would use and that he would use to go fishing, and he would take a group of people and go fishing somewhere in California, and he would take a bus. And he was a very cautious man. He had all sorts of things in backups for almost everything. The He also flew a private plane. He had his own plane. And one day he, we were doing aluminum casting in our factory there, and we wanted to do, for various reasons, because it was profitable to do at that time, and there weren't many people who could do it, wanted to do magnesium casting. The city and county of Los Angeles didn't allow magnesium to be cast in the city and county because it has a low flash point, and so it burns very easily, and it was a hazard. So, but he wanted to get into the business of magnesium casting. So one day, he was reading the want ads, and he saw that the airport at Elsinore, California, E-L-S-I-N-O-R-E, which is off in the desert, down in the Imperial Valley, where there had been a lake. The lake was now, had dried up. Anyway, that airport was going to be auctioned off. So he flew down and bought it at the auction, and he was going to use that as a place to cast his magnesium. Well, before he got around to getting his building established and all that, the Army came along and rented it to do a topographical survey and paid him almost as much for the 4 months, I think, that they leased the airport, the 6 months they leased the airport, as he had paid for the airport. So that was very good. And then the next thing, you know, somebody discovered oil right on the edge of his property. Not on his property, but right on the edge of his property. And so Jack flew down with, I think, another couple and their child, and he went to look at where the oil well was, and as I say, he was an extremely cautious man, but he banked his plane too sharply and it crashed, mm-hmm. and he was killed. And that was the end of that was the end of my association with him, of course. His wife then decided she was going to sell the business, and so I left and went to work somewhere else, managing a, I think the I believe it was because he had a CPA who audited the books and so on, and who had taken a liking to me, and who wanted me to go to work and manage a business making ceramics. They made, there were a man and his wife, she made artware and sold it to very upscale art gift shops, things like that, and some of the very most prominent in the country. She really did very nice things. And he sculpted dogs and had done them, had won the awards given by the American Kennel Association as being the standard of the breed and so on. So his dogs were very authentic. And this was very upscale pottery and so on. They knew nothing about running the business, but they had very good quality artwork. So their CPA had wanted me to go in and do the management part of the business. At this point, I'm all of 23, 24, something like that, which I did for a while, and it really didn't work very well, and I was anxious to do something which was perhaps more challenging than running that business, and they had very strict ideas about how they wanted things done, which didn't coincide with my views about how things should be done. So I worked there for only a few months, and then I went to manage, and with the idea that maybe I would buy a factory making shoe polish.
You're a man of all with many hats.
Yeah,
yes.
Right. And throughout my life, I mean, I always have been willing to do things, you know, to try something. But anyway, and I went into to that business, and that. I think it was during that period that I decided that I had made the wrong decision. So this was 1952. I had made the wrong decision that I ought to go to graduate school. I had started to go to graduate school in 1948. Now, 3 years later, I decided that perhaps I had made the wrong decision. Of course, by this time, I was married. My wife was working. And so we decided that I would go to graduate school. I enrolled in graduate school at UCLA in February of 1953. Right.
Okay. In with the goal of
getting a PhD.
Right. In economics.
In economics, right. Now, at that time, I had no idea. I mean, nowadays people are maybe then people were very careful about the choice of graduate schools and really worried about them. There wasn't all the fellowship money that was available and all that. So for me, my wife was working in L.A. I never thought about going out of L.A. I thought about going either to UCLA or Southern California. And chance had it that I chose UCLA. I had no reason for choosing it other than the fact that it was cheaper and perhaps a bit closer, but not much, I mean, from where we lived. Really no valid reason for choosing it. I mean, I would be shocked if one of my, if an undergraduate student here chose his graduate school as casually as I chose mine. But it turned out to be very good.
And you also had to pay for that?
Yes, but tuition was modest. And I worked at night, and my wife worked during the day. I had a job at night running. They had May Department Stores, which owns Kaufman's here. May Department Stores were expanding with the branch stores out in the suburbs, and they would be open. Some of them would be open on Wednesday night, and some of them would be open on Tuesday night, and so on. And of course, and I used to manage the credit department for these stores on at night. What would happen is people would come in, and they had a credit limit on various accounts, and we had a group of people, a lot of people who worked the files, and when the calls came in, they either approved the credit or they didn't approve the credit. But if they weren't going to approve the credit, they had to come to me, and I was supposed to be the person who decided whether they issued the credit or allowed the credit or didn't allow the credit. And then there were other things. I mean, there would be days when our own store, the downtown store where all the records were, would be open, and at night I would be responsible for authorizations and approvals to it.
Excuse me. What was your wife's job?
My wife worked as a sort of a secretary, bookkeeper, manager for a small business making garbage disposers.
Were they making them at that time?
Yeah, sure. Well, we had one going all the way back. We had the first one that I ever saw was in the house that my father bought when he remarried back in 1937. We had a garbage disposal made. We had a dishwasher and a garbage disposal in that house in 1937.
Do you remember the brand name?
General Electric, yeah.
No kidding.
I remember it because General Electric had installed the kitchen, and people used to come. I mean, it was quite important. People used to come, and they would come to look at it because all these things were so new. I mean, you didn't have to carry out the garbage. I mean, you just ground it up, and you didn't have to wash the dishes. You just put them in this. I mean, we've all become used to that as a standard of life. But this was in 37. 37.
It was the house of the future.
It really was. I mean, it was a new suburb, and General Electric had made this a model kitchen.
Uh-huh. That's interesting. Now I lost my train of thought. Okay. So you did your graduate work at UCLA?
At UCLA, right.
Did you get a master's and a PhD?
You got a master's on the way to a PhD. I mean, if you passed your exams for the PhD, they gave you a master's degree. So I was there a very short time. I started in February of 53, and I completed my exams in May or June of 55. So I was only there about 2.5 years.
Don't do that anymore, do they?
No.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any mentors, both at Duke and at UCLA?
Absolutely. Well, not so much at Duke.
Yeah.
But at UCLA, I certainly had mentors. That's why I said it was good. It was chance that brought me there. I met a man named Carl Bruner, K-A-R-L-B-R-U-N-N-E-R, who will feature in my life story over and over again because we worked a lot together. Anyway, Bruner was a young assistant professor at that time who had come from Switzerland, had spent a year at a very prominent research group called the Coles Commission, C-O-W-L-E-S Commission at the University of Chicago, and then had been hired as an assistant professor at UCLA, and I think he was in his second year.
Can I ask you one thing?
Sure.
You say he came from Switzerland before World War II?
No, he came after World War II. He came as a Rockefeller the Rockefeller Foundation had set up fellowships for, I guess, for European academics to come to the United States, because so many of them had been cut off from the research activities that had been going on. And he, as it came as a Rockefeller Foundation fellow to Harvard, didn't like it at Harvard and moved to Chicago, and the Coles Commission, which was really very much in the leadership of new ways of thinking about new kinds of research on economic problems. The use of statistics and mathematics, which had become the dominant theme of, in economics, but it was new at that time.
Were they using computers yet?
No, computers, the computer had been invented, but it wasn't being used in any university, as far as I know, at that time.
Now tell us, I'm sorry I distracted you.
That's okay.
Okay, so he was your first
mentor. He was my mentor, right. He used to come down and look for the graduate students and talk to them. And he did lots of good things as far as students were concerned. He would come down and he would say, let's go have coffee or some such thing as that. And then talk to you about how do you think about this problem, or here's a problem, what do you think of this problem, and try to draw you out to help you to learn to use what you were learning and to think about it, and encourage. Now that's my clock. And would do things like, at that time, mathematics was coming very strongly, and a man named Paul Samuelson, who later became quite prominent, was the second person to win the Nobel Prize in economics. Paul Samuelson had written a book called The Foundations of Economic Analysis, which was a heavily mathematical book, at least for that time. And Bruner taught a course, volunteered at night to take the graduate students who were interested in doing it through that book, helping them to understand how the role, how the mathematics and how the economics work together. I mean, it's very, very important. Taught a course, which was a for-credit course in logic and scientific method. He was just a really, for students who were interested in it, he was an outstanding teacher, and I was very attracted to him.
I noticed in your bibliography and your CV that he comes up quite
all
often.
All the time, sure.
Okay, but Samuelson, he was not at UCLA.
No, he was at MIT.
Okay.
But he had written a book, which
right.
was called The Foundation. Right. There were two books written about the same time. Both authors received the Nobel Prize. One was Samuelson's Foundations of Economics, and the other was a book by a man named John Hicks, an Englishman, called Value of Capital. And both of these had a revolutionary impact on the way in which economists went about what they did.
Okay, and those dates about?
Well, Samuelson's book was, and Hicks had been written before the war, right? But
okay.
It was really, but it takes a good 10 years before these things really began to percolate through the profession. And so most people knew about this work, but it was still novel and hard work. I mean, we were learning all sorts of new techniques.
What were economists doing before mathematics was so important?
Well, science in general is, at least in part, a matter of coming back to the same old problems with newer techniques and trying to learn more about them. So they were working on many of the same questions. They just weren't able to make as deep a penetration, understand them as well, understand. I mean, a lot that needs to be done is to learn where the thing that you're thinking about doesn't work and why it doesn't work in that area and what you need to do to supplement it to understand the range over which the proposition may hold or not hold and why it may not hold, so that you get a much deeper understanding of all the qualifications. So a lot of what mathematics did for economics was to do that. It formalized a lot of the system. It told you what assumptions you had to make in order to be sure that this proposition could be logically true, and to set up much more rigorous ways in which to test the proposition, because you could formulate it so much more clearly. So a lot was to go back over questions which were very old questions in economics, but to bring them up to date. I mean, as an example, quite apart from that, I mean, economics started with the question about why are some nations rich and some nations poor, right? The wealth of nations. That's still a very actively researched topic in economics, and learning more about the political, social, other factors. I mean, Adam Smith certainly gave a good view of some of the important factors, but by no means did he put it in the kind of rigorous way that would stand up to scrutiny or empirical tests that people do nowadays.
It's still good reading. What was the date of Adam Smith?
1776.
Right.
Same year as the Declaration of Independence.
Right. Okay. So you got your PhD.
Not yet. I got my master's. We've got my master's.
Oh, you got
still
your
have
master's.
To write a thesis.
Okay. Tell us about your thesis.
Right. Well, first, this was...
Excuse me.
Wait, one
thesis.
Second.
I have to write a thesis, right.
Okay.
I got my master's in the spring of 55. I had taken my qualifying examinations for the PhD, passed them, and I had applied for a fellowship and a scholarship from the scholarship from the Fulbright and the fellowship from the Social Science Research Council to write my thesis in France on... Brunner had become interested in something called the money supply. How and why did money get created? Why did it increase? How did it increase? What did it have to do with inflation? Things of that kind. Subject which turned out to be important because later we got into a lot of inflation. But at that time, no one was so much concerned about inflation, but they'd had a lot of inflation in Europe and they'd had a lot of different experience. And I had always I'd taken a lot of French as a student, and I always liked France, and so I thought that would be a good place to spend a year. And so my wife and I were planned to go to France and write my thesis, and we had a baby. So the Fulbrights all went over together by those days by ship, and we, because our baby was born in September and they were leaving in September, we didn't leave until a month later. So we went over by ourselves and arrived in Paris, as it turned out, with this six-week-old infant.
Named?
Bruce.
And the date of his birth?
He was born on September the 7th, 1955.
Okay.
So I think at the end of October, we went to France. So at that time, that's about right. He was about 6 weeks old. And we flew. We flew to New York and we took the ship. That's right, we took the ship. Went on the United States, which was a relatively new ship at that time. And we went on the United States. And got to Paris and had to find, the Fulbrights put us up in a little hotel. An interesting story there, which had nothing to do with my career, but it's an interesting story. We lived in this little old Left Bank hotel. We shared a bathroom with another couple that lived on the floor. There were only two of us on the floor. And the other couple actually was a woman, and she had a little baby. And the baby, and she was Chinese. And the baby was, she and my wife, I would be out during the day looking for a more permanent location. And that wasn't easy to do in Paris at the time. I mean, housing had been destroyed. Apartments were not easy to find. Anyway, she would make, my wife, who's very good at communicating with people, and she communicated with a Chinese woman, and they...
In what language?
In English. English, and the Chinese probably spoke some French, and my wife probably spoke a little bit of French, but they managed to get... Anyway, the other family were the Ma's, and the baby that was there was Yo-Yo Ma.
How
of course, later became
yeah.
the world's one of the world's premier musicians.
Excuse me, one minute. The woman's baby, Yo-Yo Ma's mother, Mrs. Ma,
and they were living there because the father, they had a tiny apartment, and the father was teaching Yo-Yo's sister, who was at that point 3 or 4, to play the piano. And she later became something else. She didn't become a musician. But in any case, there was no room for the father, the piano, the whole family in the apartment. And so Madame Ma and Yo-Yo were living in the hotel, and they were sharing this little place with us.
So your son and Yo-Yo are the same age?
Same age, just about the same age.
And are they friends?
No, they don't know each other at all. They don't know each other at all. They didn't see each other beyond the time that they were too young to recognize each other. in any case, we went on to, we did find an apartment, and we rented in the 17th arrondissement an apartment which was we shared with a Russian immigrant family. There were a lot of Russian immigrant families from the revolution, and this family had fallen on hard times, and so they had taken half of their apartment and made it into a tiny kitchen. We had a bedroom, a living room, a kitchen. We shared a bathtub with them, and we lived there for the rest of that year.
And were you associated with a university?
As part of the Fulbright, you were supposed to be associated with some university, the Social Science Research Council. I was on my own to pursue whatever I wanted to do. And, of course, getting both stipends, or at least part of both stipends, helped me to live under those circumstances, because Paris was expensive even then. It was an interesting experience. I mean, there were no baby food, all the things that you take for granted. We didn't have a doctor. We did find the American hospital eventually. But we really had to shift for ourselves to a considerable extent with Bruce. Anyway, the Fulbrights wanted me to enroll somewhere, and so I enrolled at a place called Sciences Politiques, the Institute of Sciences Politiques. And I went there a few times, but that really didn't seem to be a satisfactory place, and so I began to look around. I tried the National Library, the Bibliothèque Nationale, and eventually worked in two research institutes. One was the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which was started there in the home, what had formerly been the home of the Rothschild family. It was a beautiful place. Of course, now they've got all kinds of office buildings built around it. But anyway, at that time, it was less crowded. I worked there where I worked at a research institute of the French government called the National Statistical Research Institute.
So you had access to those libraries?
I had access to those
libraries. Which you needed to do.
Right. Yeah, at that time, a French house, people didn't read at home, and you didn't take books out of the library. If you went to the library, you read the book in the library, and then you left it in the library, and books didn't circulate in the way in which we Americans were used to. And in our apartment, the electric bulbs were 15 watts at maximum, and so reading was not something that you wanted to do. We changed that, of course. We bought some bigger bulbs, blew some fuses as a result.
Sounds like an exciting. So you were there.
An interesting experience.
Right, 1 year.
1 year, right? Uh-huh. We went in late October and came home in August. I was supposed to find a job that year to start teaching, and so while I was there, among other things, working on my thesis, I also was trying to find a job, and I was hired as a lecturer, because I didn't have my thesis finished yet, at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. The economics department at that time was in the Wharton School.
Okay. Now let me ask you a question. You did this research essentially truly on your own in Paris.
Yeah.
There was no such thing as a supervisor or mentor for you.
Well, I had...
there was no fax or anything?
Bruner had a model. I mean, he had developed a model for thinking about this problem, and I had to modify his model for the French institutions. And... collect data and try to test some of these relationships. So in that sense, I was on my own. There were other people around. The French at that time were totally uninterested in anything. I mean, they thought that money supply had nothing to do with inflation, that it had nothing to do with anything. I mean, so most of the French people, the French economists that I met, were not interested in what I was doing at all. I mean, that's changed now, but at the time that was...
Okay. What's the title of your thesis?
The title of my thesis is The French Money Supply, 1938 to 1954.
Okay.
The French Money Supply.